is Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Hey, everybody, it's Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle. The opening drive is brought to you by Cherish. Still waiting on the shipment from Cherish. Any day now, big case of Cherish will show up here, Jim. It's going to be great. Big show coming up today. We got the professor, John Clayton, at 4 o'clock, as we do every day. And then the Hall of Famer, the man, the myth, the legend that is, Walter Jones, will be with us at 5 o'clock. Looking forward to talking to it. It's funny, he's so present in the media. He's part of the postgame show on TV. As a player, you didn't hear from Big Walt.
No, you didn't. And they used to have a fine system going on anytime that you talked to the media, you got fined. Because I remember Robbie Toback walking in the background going, oh, fine for Big Walt, because he was on the air talking to somebody. What a nice guy.
He's a great guy.
I'll talk about this, but I don't know if you guys remember the story where I went out and represented Cortez Kennedy for the Ring of Honor.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and Walt came over and gave me Cortez Kennedy's button with a big 96 on it.
You didn't have one or something?
I didn't have one, and it was his special one that he had, and he came over, and he pinned it on me, and I was like, afterwards, I'm pretty sure he just made me his prom date.
It was like a corsage.
Yeah.
Just keep going, Dave.
Yeah, I know. I see you over
Stop,
there, Jim.
Jim.
I see you
Stop, over there. Jim's hoping you run into some rough terrain and just keep trying to plow through.
No.
Should I say it,
Jim, or not?
Yeah, go for it.
Oh, yeah, there we go. No, but it was just such a nice gesture by him. And, you know, it's funny because we'll talk about this, but I got the first two or three years of Cortez Kennedy's career, and then Walter came, you know, for his last two or three years. And yes, that is correct, 360. That is the word that I was going to use there. But he's going to be great to talk to because he was down on the field for the NFL 100. And, and also his buddy Hutch got in there.
We were spoiled with those two, right? You knew you had it good as a Seahawks fan. You knew how good they were. You didn't realize the drought that was going to follow their presence. Right.
I mean, that poison pill that the Vikings put in there.
Yeah. I mean, that whole thing was screwed up. We don't need to relitigate that whole thing and who messed up and blah, blah, blah. Just having that kind of dominance. They were dominant on that side of the line. I mean, imagine those guys if they were here with Marshawn. As good as Marshawn was, how much better would he have been with those guys there? Or how much better would Carson or anybody? I mean, that was such a dominant pair.
Yeah.
And you sort of, at the time, you knew it. But now you really appreciate it because it's been such a massive problem for this team for years.
You know what I remember about that 2005 season real quick is that they lost to Washington. I think it was a missed field goal by Josh Brown. That was one of their losses. It was pretty early in the season. They ran on third down. They needed a third down to pick up. They had third and one, and they ran like an ISO blast that was over Walter Jones and Steve Hutchinson with Sean Alexander carrying the ball, Max Strong is the lead blocker, and they didn't pick up the first down.
Literally like one out of 20.
And that's the only reason I remember that play is like you just expected that to happen. And it also kind of speaks to the fact that everybody in the NFL is good, but also you were just so used to that. It was just they were going to pick it up. And Hutch and Walt, one of the things I want to ask him about, I've heard that when you're in the Hall of Fame, there's a point where they are all in this room, and then everybody leaves except for the players. So it's just the Hall of Fame guys in there, and guys stand up and talk about it. But, like, you know, the waiters and everybody leaves the room. And it's just a really cool group, I think, of all of the Hall of Fames to me. Obviously, I'm biased, but it's the one that, like, wow, if you're a Hall of Famer, it means a lot.
Mm. Yeah,
I was. I just look back. I was looking at his Wikipedia page, and we all remember how great he was, all pro and, you know, retired number by the Seahawks, Ring of Honor, all these different things, NFL top 100. He allowed 23 sacks in 12 seasons, and he only had 9 holds. Nine holding penalties in 12 years.
All right. Let's be
so there was years.
Nine called holds.
Well, okay. Nine.
Well, hey.
Nine called.
Well, do you think he was like kind of like Michael Jordan, where he got the benefit of the doubt on a lot of them?
Probably.
It's like, you know, the guy's looking and go, yeah, that guy got his tail blocked off because that's Walter Jones. Yeah. But, I mean, look, not taking anything. I remember he had – the only time I saw – Mike Holmgren was great with the media. Wasn't he?
He was terrific.
It's so nice and just accommodating. And one time he got a little bit irritated because somebody asked about Walter Jones and if he thinks, you know, because I think he gave up two sacks in a game, which is just unheard of. And
two of his career, 12.
Yeah. And he,
or whatever.
And 23. He, 23. Holmgren looks at him. He's like, have you seen Walter Jones play? And the guy just kind of melted into his seat. So
well, I'm sorry, that was a terrible question. Yes. Please retract that from the record. Yeah, he's. I mean, what a absolute stud. Him and Hutch as well. I mean, again, to have a tandem like that is rare. And these days, it really makes you appreciate how good they were when you watch the problems this line has had over the years. So we'll talk to him coming up at 5 o'clock. We'll continue our countdown. Every day, we're taking a look at a Seahawk free agent. We just did 10. There's more than that. But we just did the top 10. Yesterday it was Luke Wilson. We sort of debate whether the Seahawks should stay or go, whether the player should stay or go. I think we landed on go with Luke, unfortunately. I think it feels wrong.
Yeah,
it feels wrong to say that.
It does feel wrong.
But if we're being practical, we're being GMs, we're looking at how do you build the best team here. And production-wise, it was just hard to make the case. 8 catches, 79 yards, no touchdowns in 8 games. It's just, I still don't feel right saying it, but yeah, I think we said you got to move on from that. But today we'll take another look at another player. We'll do one each day until we get to the biggest free agent concern for this team, which I'm sure most people could guess who that is. So we'll do one each day. Meanwhile, if another former
Clowney.
Is it?
Yeah.
That's not how the tease works, Dave. Where's Mora? Mora's got to be just...
Well, how can you possibly tease that? Everybody knows number one is Clowney.
Well, you never know.
Well, who's it going to be? Kendricks over Clowney?
It could have been. You never know. We might have a different spin
on it.
It's
Clowney.
The tease is still lost on him, Mora. I tried.
Ah, you guys, you're killing me.
Mora's back there just shaking her
like
head.
Like, how many Seahawk fans would actually be surprised?
And I've got Taylor texting me asking why Dave is not on the video.
I said
he's actively
video.
Avoiding it.
He's trying to show off his hair. He just wants only his hair to be seen
here,
on the video.
I'll fix it. There we go.
Yeah, if you guys want to see what we're talking about, the new system is up, 710sports.com. Just click that watch live button and you can watch the show. You can interact, you can chat on there, and you can see the top of Dave's head. He looks like a little kid.
I'm comfortable. I got a knee problem going on right now.
Who's the character they said you look like yesterday?
Kilroy.
Yeah. I don't know who that is, but he said it was accurate.
To the camera being on each one of us when we talk. I think that's
I got a knee problem.
Yeah, the camera's getting in the way of my knee situation here. So, yeah, head to 710sports.com, click Watch Live. You can check out the new video system that is happening here, and you can interact. Everybody's chatting on there as well. Meanwhile, Cliff Averill joined Joe Fan on his Talkin' Seahawks podcast, had some interesting comments. And Dave, I'm specifically curious to see how you respond to what he had to say, because here's the quote. If you can steal a sack on 2nd and 7, if you can steal a sack on some play actions on first down where they have to throw the ball or you have a lead and they have to come back, it definitely makes it a little easier. The one-score games do show that your team is resilient. He said it does show that your team can play all the way through the fourth quarter and different things like that. But as far as the pass rush in particular, it makes it extremely hard and difficult for those guys to be able to get sacks. So what do you make of what he had to say there?
Well, it's kind of interesting because, look, the Seahawks have come from behind so many times that, you know, and Russell Wilson has this record in the NFL since 2012. I think he is, as far as active players, he has the most fourth quarter and overtime comeback wins, 32 of them. And how many did he have? I think we had 3 10-point deficit come from behind wins. You know, and it seems so unlikely too, because when you go through and look at the Super Bowl, I mean, that's what they were down by 10. Mm-hmm. The Chiefs were, and in the fourth quarter they basically came back, and yeah, so it's just hard to do. But there's a point to that. You know, when you're playing, when you can, you hear the phrase "pin your ears back." You know, and that means you just go get the quarterback. And we heard that from a couple of different players this year. It was from Jaron Reed, and we heard it from Quentin Jefferson that, you know, that was the reason why they got after the quarterback so much in the San Francisco game. That was, what, their 10th game? And at that point, going in after 9 games, they had only 15 sacks. So, and, you know, they got 5 in that game. So there definitely is something to that because, you know, if you're playing the run, you know, you're kind of taking care of your gap. I don't want to say you're stepping sideways, but you're certainly not going north and south, you know. And we saw it with, like, Michael Bennett would do this every once in a while. And that's how the whole run gap integrity chicken came home to roost. And we were talking about that is that, you know, guys were running upfield. So, you know, you not only create space, you know, width-wise, but that's depth-wise, where in the box, I mean, there's, you got one guy way upfield, and you got another guy, you know, that's kind of at the line of scrimmage, so one guy's kind of playing the run, the other guy is, you know, going after the passer, and it just creates lanes that running backs can run in. So, yeah, it makes it more difficult. So I see his point there. Mm-hmm. I do, but I think also it was a lot about, you know, how they decided to play and that they decided that they weren't going to be super aggressive because, you know, being, you know, pass rush. I'm trying to remember the call where the D-line coach always had like a, you know, a separate call with the D-line of, you know, hey, you can go get them, you know, pass rush or play run or whatever. So, yeah, that's definitely a thing. I see his point there. I see Cliff's point, but I don't know about making it incredibly difficult, although he's the pass rusher. So he would know, right?
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they were, I feel like they can fix this problem fairly quickly. I mean, you obviously have to go out into free agency, but I think a lot of it was just the way the games were called. I think they said, hey, I don't think we have a lot of great pass rushers going into this game or season. You hope that somebody flashes, but that really wasn't their forte. I mean, you look at like what Pittsburgh does. I was texting this morning with Keith Butler, who's the D coordinator for the Steelers, and they just turn it loose, man. They're just aggressive. They go get it, just a different style. And, you know, for Pete, it's pretty much always been, hey, let's lay back and, you know, we're trying to take the ball away, but let's just play good, solid defense. We'll keep everything in front of us, and we're not going to take a lot of chances. So, and then you also faced a couple of, three different times, and try to think if there's anybody else, but you had Kyler Murray twice.
Yeah.
And then you had Lamar Jackson. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there were some quarterbacks that you don't necessarily want to do with that. You know, I remember watching when Tyrod Taylor was in college, Stanford, that just stands out to me. But in a bowl game, they just kind of did this sort of pocket rush. And I think Clayton called it like a crab rush. He heard from, you know, some guys talking about it that I think it was Houston, that they were doing this to, you know, Lamar Jackson, because you don't want to go flying upfield and create all these spaces for him to run.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at it and I can see Cliff's point. But then what the Seahawks system has worked. I was just going back again. They were 10-2 in one score games, 11-5 this year with that defense. And so I can see, you know, being a little more aggressive though. And there's also that stat that tells you that when the Seahawks have a 4-point lead at halftime, it's been a long time since they've lost. They've got an incredible streak going. Mm-hmm. They're unbeaten with a 4-point lead or more at halftime over the course of 2 or 3 years. So it's all in keeping of this theme of people lately, though, talking about the Seahawks needing to be more aggressive. And I think there was a quote, too, in Joe Fan's story there, NBC Sports Northwest, from Warren Sharp. Warren Sharp football, 80% of the teams that have a halftime lead end up going on to win. So, yeah, I'd kind of like to see the Seahawks be a little more aggressive in the first half.
But do they have the talent
to build a bigger lead and – I don't know why I didn't even think about that. And I'm going, well, yeah, that makes sense, Cliff. If you got a 10-point lead on somebody, they're going to abandon the run and it's going to open up more. And if you're going to have the same type of pass rushers next year, you got to do something. You either got to build a bigger lead or blitz or try some different scheme, because it's not going to cut it just having 28 sacks.
Is one a symptom of the other? They don't have the talent, or the talent hasn't developed yet, thus they have to play more conservative. They do have to give more room because these guys, whether it's Blair, whether it's Amadi, or whether whoever, they just don't seem to have that faith in them to be aggressive and play up on a guy. Do you look at it as lack of talent, lack of developed talent, or it's the scheme? But the scheme could be part of the other problem.
Well, I'm sorry not to answer one of or the other. I would say it's a lack of trust. And we saw, I think we saw a lot of that this year. I heard. Jake,
what do you mean by that exactly? Because you've mentioned that with Trey Flowers quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, for Trey individually, he needs to trust himself because he has penalties that he doesn't need to foul the guy on, and he has him covered. But he kind of I don't want to use the word panics because he's a cool dude. I mean, he pretty much, you know, is a pro and everything. But I think he unnecessarily, you know, so that's kind of different for him. I think. We saw it a lot this year. I heard Jake Heaps talking about it when I was coming in about playing, you know, Blair a little bit more. And I'm with him, man. I loved Blair, and I thought that they should have trusted him to put him out there on the field. I think they, to some level, they trusted Lano Hill
and Tedrick Thompson.
But don't you think that Blair wasn't good enough to be out there, or they would have had him out there? Same with Amadi.
Like, they've always played rookies, though.
They have, and maybe these rookies weren't exactly what they thought they were going to be when they drafted them, though. That's what I come back to. I heard Jake saying that, too, and I was thinking, yeah, everybody liked Marquise Blair, what we saw of him in August, and then I get misled in August seeing some of those games, but you like the hits and everything that he had, and you thought, man, there's some Cam Chancellor pop in that kid, and yet there were probably good reasons why those players weren't out there.
Yeah, I think... Look, these are good coaches here, and they know what they're looking at, and they know how they want to play it, but I just think they wanted to be a little bit more conservative, and, you know, maybe it was, to me, it's like a lack of trust. How come we didn't see Amadi? How come, like with Shaquem Griffin, I mean, all the talk going into camp was, this guy's not a linebacker.
Right.
And they were talking about the pass rush component of him, and then we didn't really see it until midway through the season they started using it.
Yeah, and that's one that we had talked about early in the year, and I would say, yeah, they already thought of that, right? But then all of a sudden they threw him in, and look, with the speed, I mean, it seemed to work out. But, you know,
do you think they could have been looking at that in practice and weren't seeing the results they wanted, and then maybe they started to see it and said, okay, now.
Well, and they kept using Ansa. I kept hoping Ansa, yeah, I kept hoping Ansa wasn't going to play because I wanted to see more of Griffin, because it's like, I don't think he's going to be worse than Ansa, so let's see what you have. That's the thing when you talk
about. You made a big investment in Ansa, and if you were looking at him saying, listen, the reason he's not been as impactful as we hoped is because he hasn't gained the weight back, or the injury wasn't completely healed. But we're seeing improvements in both of those areas throughout the week. I understand why they kept running him out there. You did make a bit. We looked it up yesterday. It was a fairly substantial commitment financially in exchange for what they got, which was a lot of nothing. So I understand why they felt compelled to run him out there. Maybe they were seeing those improvements through practice. Hey, he looks stronger. He looks a little bit bigger. He's putting on some weight. The shoulder looks like it's getting better. I get that. It didn't turn out. I agree with you, but I understand why they did that.
But, you know, there's a personality of a team, you know, of how you feel like, you know, what kind of – and like for the Seahawks, they always want to start. And I was going through and looking. I don't have all the numbers together, but I was just looking at, like, the first quarter. Like, why do the Seahawks not start off fast? You know, and, you know, some of these things you would think are like the 18% of their pass attempts occurred in the first quarter. So you'd think it should be 25, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't as bad as I thought. But and then the other thing is, you know, Russell was about 64-65% in the first quarter. One of the things that really blew me away is 10% of the penalties that they had this year occurred in the first quarter, because I thought that might be it. You know, and then, you know, I looked at punts, like about a third of their punts occurred in the first quarter. And so, you know, there was a fair mixture of run and pass. It wasn't like they were just being totally conservative, you know. And so and even when they were, like, just as an example, they ran it three times against Green Bay. Now, why would you do that, you would think? Because you don't have your main guys. They were all three to Marshawn Lynch. But they were the number 24 run defense. So that was not an unsound thing to do. So, yeah, but you'll like this, Jim. The coin tosses, maybe they should. They were 10-8, okay, in coin tosses. They won 10 and lost 8, and then they were 7-3 in those games where they won, and they were 5-3 in those games that they lost the coin toss. So that really pretty much tells you nothing.
Okay, I'm glad you passed it along, though.
Yeah. So it's a 50-50. But, you know, they always defer, and they want to play defense first.
Yeah, which I don't understand with that defense they had this year.
Yeah, so if you're going through and looking at first quarter stats, the coin toss matters.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you get the ball first, and that's one thing I thought it could be as simple as that. You know, I know, and it looks like when they lost, Everybody does that. I mean, every team that they lost a coin toss to, they played They played defense first.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's maybe it's something as simple as that. Or and if you mix that with what you always talk about, Bob, going up tempo a little bit in the first quarter. But, you know, it's just kind of Pete's coaching style. They've always kind of been that way, that it's like, okay, you know, they're great halftime adjustment guys. They're great in the second half. And that's just the personality of this team. Yeah, maybe they need to take a look at that and change it a little bit. But I'll just go ahead and say this, too, at this point. They won 12 games this year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're tearing it down and you know, trying to figure out, oh, what do they need to do to, you know, they did a pretty good job.
Let's take two.
Take two.
Washington State added Alphonse Oiwak, a local four-star cornerback recruit from Kent today. Nick Rolovich was able to maintain 17 of the 18 early commits as the 2020 recruiting class signs their letters of intent.
You know what they're doing, Jim?
What's that, Dave?
Wazoo is building a fence around the state of Washington.
That's right, Dave. That's what they're doing. And Oiwak, he had a verbal commitment to Arizona, and they got him to flip, Dave. They got him to flip. So he's
since the coaching change, he flipped?
Since the coaching change, yeah. So Rolovich is going to make more of an effort in-state. And the Huskies, you didn't hear too much from them today because the earlier signing period, they got all their guys. And they were, I think, ranked second in the Pac-12. They had a great recruiting class themselves.
Mm. All right. Good news for the coach, though, right? That's got to make you feel good if you were somebody that was lamenting the departure of Mike Leach.
Yeah, the part of it of keeping 17 of the 18 that committed when Leach was the coach and then able to keep them. So, yeah, good sign there.
The Red Sox have reportedly sent Mookie Betts and David Price to the Dodgers pending physicals. And in unfortunate former Mariners news, James Paxton will miss 3 to 4 months following back surgery.
Wow. Wonder how that happened. Came about.
I feel bad for James Paxton. I like the guy. I still root for him. He couldn't have been a nicer guy. And when he's healthy, he's one of the most dominant lefties in the entire game. But this has been his story. He just can't stay healthy.
He had a microscopic lumbar discectomy. Discectomy? Yeah. And a cyst removed, too. So we'll see. Boy, 3 to 4 months. He was taking injections for the pain and he still had the pain and so had to have the surgery. And so, yeah, tough news. James Paxton, love him.
Meanwhile, the Dodgers are going to spend a bunch of money to re-sign Mookie Betts to a long-term contract, and they take on a portion anyway. I think the Red Sox, I read, are going to pick up a portion of David Price's remaining contract, somewhere in the $96 million range is what he's left. That's a bad deal that they signed there with David Price, or they're just shipping him off.
Who's the color guy on radio there, Maura? And remember David Price and him got in a fight on the plane?
Eckersley.
Yes. Was it
Dennis Eckersley?
Yes.
Yeah. I was like, wow, you went up to the color guy on the radio broadcast and on the plane confronted
who's
him.
Pretty well beloved there.
Yeah.
I heard somebody saying that Mookie Betts, after this year, he could be in line for a $400 million contract.
Yeah.
$400
million. He's one of the great young players in the game. It's weird that I'll be curious to see how this goes with the Red Sox.
Bobby's not that good. He's not $400 million good, is he?
Who is $400 million good?
Talk to us in 5 years. Yeah, $400 million will be chump change.
Be a bargain.
I don't think there's many that you would pay more than him, and he's young.
Yeah, he's in that conversation.
Like $400 million, what, for 10 years or for 8 years, 12 years, what?
We'll find out. It's going to get more and more outrageous, Jim. That's how it's going to go.
Okay.
This will be a Dave's right. 5 years from now, he'll be going, man, they got him at a bargain rate. That was great. All right, coming up, how do the Seahawks close the gap on the 49ers, and just how big is that gap between these two teams? We'll talk about it next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio. Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Coming up at 4 o'clock, the Professor John Clayton will join us on the program. Walter Jones, the Hall of Famer, one of the great Seahawks of all time, will join us at 5 o'clock, and then we'll continue with our list of Seahawks free agents to be. We're going 10-1. We put out the top 10. We did Luke Wilson yesterday. We're going to debate whether they stay or whether they go. And there's some tough choices. We've got to make tough choices here.
We're GMs.
Yeah, we're junior GMs, much like a lot of the people that we'll text in sometimes.
Yeah, somebody just texted in the Seahawks don't watch film.
They don't.
That's why the first half is bad. It's basically film study.
So they're not watching film? Somebody should tell Pete.
That's insane.
Yeah. That's a
that they don't watch film. I mean, I can't believe that.
That's weird. I was always under the impression they did. And here I've been wrong this whole time.
Sure enough.
It's craziness. You guys can text in 710-710 is the Coors Light text line. We'll also accumulate some of the mean texts. We'll unveil those every Friday. So people are more than willing to share
just
those.
Just make sure you do it right.
Yeah, just be clever. Just be clever.
Yeah, don't just hit somebody over the head with a 2x4. Yeah. Except the one guy who said, bleep you, Dave.
Yeah,
I thought that was pretty clever.
Because it was on the heels of all the love you were getting. We said, Dave needs a text to bring him back down to earth. And it was just very short and sweet and to the point. So it fit.
Yeah, it worked.
Meanwhile, first of all, how big of a gap do you think there is between that 49er team and the Seahawks? We're talking about a team that they beat.
Not much.
Talking about a team they almost beat a second time without courtesy of your running backs, your starting center, a tight end. I mean, you were as injury riddled as you could be, and you almost beat them.
How do you think that third game would have gone? Like, if you had to guess, I mean, you look at it and you go, well, they beat them down there once in overtime, and they came within an inch of winning at CenturyLink Field. Did you feel like that third game, if they'd beaten the Packers, was going to be close? Or
yeah.
Did you feel like the 49ers had an upper hand a little bit?
They have an upper hand because they were healthier, and they've got a decidedly better front four. And we saw that even in the game they lost. Those guys were out there wreaking havoc. So I think they had a clear advantage on the pass rush. They were decidedly healthier. I don't think they had any health concerns going into the Super Bowl.
Yeah, they pretty much got everybody back.
Yeah, so they were just in a much better position concerning that. Having said that, I just think the Seahawks, for whatever reason, are a tough matchup for them.
Well, they are. And, you know, you saw this around the league this year. And so my prediction would have been that it would have been a tight game. It would have come down to it. And that's the thing where I'm like, who's better in the fourth quarter? And we talked about that in the last segment, that Russell has 32 fourth quarter and overtime comeback wins. And it's kind of interesting how, like, the Rams are not a very good matchup for the Seahawks. Whatever it is they do offensively, you saw that this year with Arizona and San Francisco also. And you look at those scores, I think one's 28-23 and the other one was like an 8 or 9 point win, but it wasn't that close. I mean, that far apart. It was close. That was a bad matchup for them. And I go back to, you know, doing the Green Bay research going into that playoff game, the Lions, who were, I want to say 3-12-1, they led the Green Bay Packers for both of those games, the entire game. In both of those games, the Green Bay Packers were never ahead in regulation. They kicked a field goal to win both of those games. That's a crappy team, the Detroit Lions. Mm-hmm. And yet they were, whatever reason, were just a tough matchup against Aaron Rodgers. And so, you know, I always say, look, every player, there are no bad players in the NFL. There's players that don't play together. But, you know, sometimes they take away something that's your strength and they're difficult. And, you know, that to me, the Seahawks were a problem for the Niners this year. I mean, they had to make a tackle. That was pretty miraculous. That Dre Greenlaw kid, I mean,
that was a heck of a tackle.
But I think
your point about, hey, if that's Disley or a regular size tight end, I mean, Hollister's an undersized guy there.
Well, not only that, and somebody was saying, hey, should they turn Hollister into like a Juszczyk type of guy? I don't know what it is about Hollister. He used to get the crap knocked out of him.
He didn't just roll with punches.
Like
he
kept
just
coming
ran
back
into
for
him.
More, though.
He was as tough as could be. And, you know, and I was happy because Rabel told him that because he did a thing. He goes, boy, Mike, the color guy I work with, thinks that you're like the toughest. Because I do. I thought he was just so resilient. And you see him after games kind of walking around gingerly. Like, yeah, I'm like, yeah, you just got the bleep knocked out of you. And, you know, so he's tough. But he is just one of those guys, I don't think. And he's a willing blocker. But I don't think he's, you know, like a Kyle Juszczyk type where you're going to. But, yeah, I mean, you know, so getting back to it. That Greenlaw kid, he had an interception in overtime against the Seahawks in the first game, too. So, I mean, that kid, that was a great tackle. But, I mean, look, that was, you know, 2 inches away from winning the NFC West.
Yeah.
It's just hard. It's hard to believe. So, you know, a lot of the stuff.
So the gap's not that big.
Yeah. And like I said, they won 12 games this year. So it's not like it's just I think everybody's kind of out of sorts with the fact that the defense is not good.
Yeah, that's what you had 4 years in a row where this defense led the league in points allowed, which is to me is the ultimate measure of a defense. That's the ultimate stat. We can talk
about, care about
yardage and first downs and blah, blah, blah. How many points are you allowing? That's the bottom. It's a bottom line business, Jim. You ever heard that?
I have heard that, and they just keep going in the opposite direction.
They are. We got so accustomed to it, though. I mean, it was literally 4 years in a row where they led the league in that category. So to see what they've become versus what they were is a bit jarring, and I think that's part of – I think you're right. That's part of the reaction. We were talking about a historic defense, not, hey, this is the best defense in the league. Where do they rank all time? Well, that was the conversation about the Seahawks defense, and now we're talking about – yeah, they're 28th in this category. They're 29th in this category. Sacks, they're 31st. I mean, it feels weird. It doesn't feel right.
Yeah, and I think that's what's making everybody sort of more critical of this team. Now, look, you can always improve. There's no question about it. But, yeah, I mean, it was just tough to watch. And, you know, you talk about that historic run. I mean, that was like unlike anything that's been done in the NFL. Because you go back and look at the 85 Bears, I think they had a really solid two-year run there. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, the defenses were allowed to do more stuff back then.
You couldn't do anything against the 85 Bears.
Yeah, right. Marino was the only one.
Keep in mind what he was just said, though. How much more latitude did a defense have back then versus now?
Well, so maybe so, but I think the 85 Bears would have been really good now, too.
Yeah, I'm sure. But, I mean, look, you can't touch a receiver. You can't hit anybody over the middle. You can't accidentally fall on top of a quarterback.
Oh, don't do that.
Even though your momentum is taking you that way. I mean, there's all kinds of things that, you know, and some of these tackles that you see every once in a while where, like, was it KJ and Philly where he got the guy around the neck and everybody's,
yeah,
ooh.
Everybody lost their mind.
Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, would you trade the 49ers? Would you trade for the 49ers defense straight up for Seattle's defense if you had to take Garoppolo and they got Wilson?
No.
Would I have to take Richard Sherman on my team?
Yes, you would.
All right.
So exchange of defenses and quarterbacks, I think there's a much, much bigger gap between Garoppolo and Wilson.
Well, that's the thing. I was encouraged after the Super Bowl thinking, and I like Jimmy G, but it just seemed like there was a wider gap there than I realized between Garoppolo and Russell Wilson. And it's, boy, there's a big gap between the two defenses too, but you're not quite sure if Jimmy Garoppolo is a franchise quarterback right now. Now, you're stuck with him because you already paid him down there in San Francisco. But, boy, with Russell Wilson, you know you're going to be in contention every year. And I like the hangover for the second-place team in the Super Bowl, too, because we've talked about that before. And then you look at Eric Branch, the 49ers beat writer from the San Francisco Chronicle. He tweeted out that when you look ahead, the Seahawks have 6 picks in the first 4 rounds this year. The 49ers only have 1, and the Seahawks have a lot more room under the salary cap, too, to make moves.
Yeah, $60 million roughly to $21 million. So they've got a couple of advantages, and hopefully they use it properly, more importantly. Meanwhile, Pete Rose is using the sign-stealing scandal as a reason that he should be let into the Hall of Fame. Does he have a point? Talk about that next with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore.
Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
Yes, you are, Jim. Yes, you are. It is Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle. The professor, John Clayton, will join us at the top of the hour. By the way, I just saw this breaking news that Kirk Douglas has passed away at 103 years old.
Mm.
Yeah. Wow, 103.
Michael Douglas's dad.
Yep, yeah.
103.
There you go.
What else was he in?
Douglas was in.
He was in a million different things.
Yeah,
but it was
I
a
feel
long
like
time
most
ago.
Well known for that, right? That's what everybody references as Spartacus.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't there when he was older, didn't he do with some other older actor, they were like gangsters or something?
I think so. I feel like that. Was it him or Lloyd Bridges? I can't. No, I think it was him.
I always think you're right. I get them kind of mixed up with the Bridges because you know, the sons, they were the ones on Seinfeld, right?
Yeah, the Mendelbaums.
Yeah.
Mendelbaum. Mendelbaum. You think you're tougher than me?
It's go time. Meanwhile, we told you about Pete Rose using the sign-stealing scandal that the Astros are wrapped up in and the Boston Red Sox are wrapped in. And he talked about that, you know, basically being an excuse for him to be led into the Hall of Fame. Now, in my opinion, I don't think he needed this to bolster his case. I think it's been long enough. I'm not justifying what he did.
4,000 hits or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous that you've had guys who have cheated multiple times as players and been allowed back into the game and allowed into coaching or what some other avenue within the game of baseball, but here's a guy that's been blacklisted. And I know he lied. I know he lied up until, what, 2004, I guess, is when it, and then he writes a book about it. I get he's made a lot of missteps. Yet, is he just persona non grata to the point that it doesn't matter what anybody else has done, as bad as it looks for steroid use and sign stealing and all these other things? He is the bottom of the barrel. What he did is so much worse that we can't even consider that. It seems like it's been long enough.
Should you consider what he did as a player and not as a manager?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's...
He wasn't getting in on his managerial merits.
Well, I was just sitting here thinking about, okay, well, let's see what happens down the road with Altuve. If he's a Hall of Fame candidate, yeah. Maybe Bregman too. And so if they don't make it in because of this scandal, then I guess you can still hold it against Pete Rose. But I was just looking. So it's 31 years and counting that he's been banned from the game. And he's 78 years old, and
yeah. By time Altuve retires,
isn't it time to just let bygones
be
bygones? I mean, point shaving and betting against your own team, and still, I know it's not cool what he did. You shouldn't be doing what he did, but at least he wasn't betting on the other team.
Well, that's just it, and I know that sounds weird. It sounds like a weird justification, but to me, it is a difference. There is a difference if he had been found to have been betting against his team, or he was tanking a game in order to win his bet. If they could have proven something like that, then I'd be like, okay, that's challenging the integrity of the game more than just about anything else. You still have to perform if you're taking steroids. You still have to hit the ball. You still have to put the ball in play and make things happen versus him technically altering the outcome of a game and having the ability to as a manager. But as far as I know, none of that was ever found to be true. He did bet on his team, and certainly he could have adjusted his rotation to suit his bet. But
well, what the Astros did was worse.
Yeah, to me, it doesn't even touch it. I mean, I think that Marco Gonzalez, after talking to him, that's what really kind of got to me about how serious this scandal is. And this might be the best thing that ever happened to Pete Rose, because now all of a sudden people are like, man, you know, this is, I mean, the guy wasn't, you know, he was betting on his team, you know, not against him. But I'm just looking at nearly 16,000 plate appearances for him and a lifetime batting average of 303. Holy smokes.
What was his lifetime on base?
On base percentage, 375. So, yeah. I mean, he just was such a great player. And I don't know, you know, and somebody tweeted, I can't remember which pitcher did, but he was saying, hey, I'll face a guy on steroids any day. But a guy that knows what pitch is coming, you know, when to swing, when not to, man, how many times do you see really good hitters out there get fooled by like a changeup or, you know, a breaking ball that they think is going to be, you know, a smoker down the middle. And it's such a huge advantage. But, yeah, so now all of a sudden it doesn't look so bad in what Pete Rose was doing. I mean, and like you said, it wasn't when he was playing. But it opens up the question that, okay, was he doing this when he was playing? And, you know, remember that whole thing about Jameis Winston? There was a thing where, you know, somebody said something about him tanking in the second half in college and everything. I mean, once you get just a little bit of a crack in there, it just opens wide open that somebody's going to be greedy and do something for money. And, you know, that to me, I guess it now kind of falls like behind steroids and the pitch tipping.
Yeah, and you got people texting. You guys can text in 710-710 to the Coors Light text line. Most people on the side of he should be in there. We got one that says, yes, Bob, Pete Rose was banned for life. That means life in capital letters, by the way. He is not eligible and never should be. Well, then you should exact that same kind of justice on those that cheat and challenge the integrity of the game today and those that cheat and challenge the integrity of the game in the steroid era. And I'm talking about Bond shouldn't even be on the ballot then. Then Clemens shouldn't be on the ballot. Manny Ramirez, Sammy Sosa, they shouldn't be on the ballot. If that's the level we're going to hold them to, if that's the line, it's about the integrity. Okay.
Do you have a good explanation why Altuve and Bregman and the Astros players, why they weren't punished in some respect? Like I don't know, half the season?
You'd have to do it to
half
the entire
season,
roster.
A full season?
You'd have to do it to the entire roster. I know
right.
They're the face of it, but
well,
you'd have
ahead
to
do it to
Springer,
the whole roster.
Well, they got to field a team, so I don't
know.
Well,
they can field a team with some of their minor leaguers, like, you know, the Mariners. If it happened to them, bring the Rainiers over, you know. So it's like I don't care what that problem is, you know. I just don't understand why the players got away with it.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think anybody that was on that roster was complicit. Whether you partook in it as a pitcher, you were benefiting as a pitcher. It was helping you. Whether you were actually one of the people banging on the trash cans or not. You knew what was going on. I refuse to believe anybody in that dugout had no clue. Sorry.
Yeah, at least Pete Rose was, he was really, you know, I mean, he said here in his, he had a 20-page document that ESPN obtained, and it says it's never been suggested, let alone established, that any of Mr. Rose's actions influence the outcome of any game or the performance of any player. Yet for the 31st year, he continues to suffer a punishment vastly disproportionate to those who have done just that. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, he should be in. People are bringing up Shoeless Joe Jackson, which is absolutely accurate in my opinion. He should be in there. He was part of the Black Sox scandal. Yet you look at his numbers in those series, I think he hit around 380. By all accounts, he was illiterate, didn't know what he was signing, knew what was going on, did not participate. But the way I'm making the argument for the Astros, I guess he's complicit. He didn't say anything about it. He didn't partake in it, but he didn't say anything about it either. I think he should be in the Hall of Fame. Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame. To me, it's not even that big of a debate. But he's using this moment. Maybe it does bolster his case on some level. We'll see. But I think he should be in there. Meanwhile, we'll ask the professor what he thinks about Cliff Averill's comments. We read those earlier. That playing from behind hurts the pass rush. See what he thinks about that. That's coming up with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.